My name is Tom Whalen. I'm an alcoholic. And, of course, I want to thank Bob for the kind invitation again to come out here to Las Vegas, my wife and I, to tell my dreary story one more time. And enjoy coming to Las Vegas. It's just always an exciting trip and fun. And this meeting in particular, it's just full of old-timers and newcomers and just all kinds of people. And it's really a great group. And I think you deserve all the success you've had. I've been sober a long time. I've been doing this for a long time. And I think one of the dangers of being a long-term member of Alcoholics Anonymous is that you have a tendency to forget what it really used to be like. I mean, to feel it's been so long since I've been loaded, I kind of, it'd be hard to remember what it's even like. I was watching an old movie the other night. Lionel Barrymore was drunk, stumbling around, and they were trying to get him into his room in his hotel, and he was kept falling down, and all he wanted to do was get another drink. And it was, but it was actually a comedy scene. But I thought, you know, how foolish we are, you know. And I almost slapped myself in the face, and I said, "You were just like him." I don't know of any time that I ever drank that I wasn't always thinking about the next drink. I don't think that's terribly normal, but it's the way it was. I don't think I've ever had a drink that I was drinking, whether it was high school or whatever it was, that I'm always plotting and planning and thinking about the next drink. And I don't think that's the way most normal people act. I love to drink, like our first speaker. I just love every bit of it. And I know that's a terrible thing to say in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I just loved it. And I don't know why. I have no reason to feel that way. My parents didn't even drink. And my father had little or no use for people to even drink. And I had to go steal it from neighbors' houses because we didn't have any booze in the house. Because it's my mother's biggest problem when I was growing up in West Los Angeles is that what kind of a cake she was going to bake for the bridge and the old neighbors to come over and stuff like that. That was the big deal with her tea and her coffee. And I don't know why. It just fascinated me, and I loved everything about it. And I don't remember my early drinking because it was all too many years ago. But I just know that I was obsessed with it. I became a daily drinker when I was a junior in high school, and I don't really understand it sometimes. Maybe I've been sober too long now, but I look back on my life that way, and I have no excuse for being an alcoholic. I had every advantage anybody would have wanted, and yet I just, my favorite thing to do was to drink. And I was telling this dreary story a couple of years ago now at the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach, and I got to the point when I was 19 years old, and I just got out of Loyola High School, and I was screwing around Santa Monica City College, and I was either drunk or hungover or both. And all I really wanted to do was just to hang around with my friends and get loaded and drink and listen to jazz music, you know, and pass out and come to and discuss philosophy and all that sort of stuff. And it's just all so silly now. And I was kind of saddened that I didn't have anything inside of me that would have given me a kind of an ambition to go to college or what kind of a work I was going to do or whatever. I was dating this girl. It was I didn't want to be around much, and it was, I don't know. I just did kind of a dumb thing, I guess, now. In 1953, I volunteered to be drafted, and they took me up on it, and I got my notice, and I went in the Army and April of 1953, and I went overseas immediately. I went to Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. And if you're native Californian, that's overseas, as far as I'm concerned. And I got into some trouble for my drinking down there. I drank at every opportunity I had. Fortunately, or unfortunately, I had a desk job. And so most of us, at least I thought everybody else was doing it. You know, a lot of us in alcoholics, we just think everybody does what we do. But maybe I'm just looking at myself. But we had, I always carried there was a bottle in the drawer, and we drank in the morning and the afternoon, and we get all cleaned up and go into town and get drunk. And I remember one particular night, I was at the place called the Jamboree Club. There was a kind of a place in those days in Arkansas where they didn't have bars as we know them. And it was by a setup, and you'd have to bring your own bottle in. And, of course, you have to drink it all. You know, my mother taught me to waste not, want not. And so I, this particular night, not unlike other nights, but this particular night I was really too drunk to walk. And so, but I got to my car. I'm not too drunk to drive, of course, but, and I drove back to the camp with this guy in the back seat, and I passed out at the wheel. I ran my car over a bridge and turned it over 3.5 times and broke myself all up and ended up in the hospital. The only good thing that came out of that whole experience is that I understand I had at that time the highest blood alcohol of anybody in the state of Arkansas, which is kind of something to shoot for. You know, it's not like I'm a total failure. And one particular night I was one particular morning in the mess hall, I was sitting at this mess hall and hungover and whatever, and a bunch of guys came up to me and they said, "My God, Tom, what a great time we had last night." Of course, I have no idea what they're talking about. And he said, "Well, I don't know, you knew that much about jazz and whatever." And I'm just at a loss of what they're talking about. The whole evening, it was just a, I'd never even been in this place before. And I went back that same night, and the black piano player lady, she got up and stopped playing for him, gave me a big hug, and said, "What a wonderful time we had last night." And I thought, you know, and I guess it was a great time. I don't remember it, but anyway, this gal that I ran away from decided she was going to come down to visit me, ostensibly for the weekend. So she's getting off the plane in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and she says, "Well, now that I'm here, why don't we get married?" And I thought, well, okay, big strong Tom, you know. So we went off and got married and signed a suicide pact the next 20 years, and I don't know what she saw in me, except maybe she just loved to suffer. I'm really not too clear on that. And when I got out of the Army in 56, not only am I married, but I have these two children. One of them talked here a few weeks ago, I understand, Chris. But I got out of the Army, and I had no skills or anything like that, except what my father did, and that was he was an electrical contractor in West Los Angeles in the L.A. area. And so I went back to work for him. I had enough sense of responsibility in those days instilled in me that I knew I had to, you know, raise his family and do all this sort of stuff. And so I did this. And I had another thought that came to me, because I've been drinking all through the day for the last several years. I figured that drinking and during the day somehow didn't fit into the stereotypical idea of how I should behave, and so I decided to cut it off, and I did. I don't remember whether it was a problem or not. It's all too many years ago. And I don't understand I'm an alcoholic. I have no way of knowing, and because I have no role models. And what happened is I'm finding out that 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, I'm getting very nervous and uptight and kind of shaky, and maybe I'm just anxious. Maybe I'm just high-strung, as I was diagnosed as being in grammar school and high school when I would see the psychologists and psychiatrists, because I've always never been too well wrapped in my life and always had certain problems and a little weird. And I found out if I had a couple of beers for lunch, I would have a much better afternoon. In fact, you new people can take that information with you tonight. I mean, you know, relief is literally a swallow away. And so I started having a couple of beers once in a while for lunch. I'm not going to make a big thing out of it. And then it became an everyday occurrence, and I found out that drinking beer in the middle of the day made me sleepy. And then I started having a couple of vodka tonics for lunch. Make them a double, if you will. And I'd be doing that, and I couldn't tell anybody about it. I can't tell my dad, because he, as I said earlier, had little or no use for people that even drank. I can't tell my wife, because she couldn't understand why I'd be drinking in the middle of the day. It's going to be my little secret. And she had kind of a strange idea of drinking anyway. I mean, she drank, but certainly not to the extent that I enjoyed drinking. But I bought a quart of bourbon or scotch or vodka, whatever I'm drinking that season, and I put it on the kitchen sink on Friday night when I came home from work. And that was going to be the bottle for the week. And usually Sunday she would say to me things like, what happened to that bottle you bought the other night? There's nothing left in it. And I said, well, I don't know what happened to it. Maybe you had a drink out of it. I don't know, you know. I don't want to get involved in these controversies, you know. And so I may be alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. You buy two quarts on a Friday night. You put one in the kitchen sink, to put the other one in the garage. You work bottle A and a bottle B and watch the line go up and down. It's a lot of goddamn work, but it keeps her mouth shut about my drinking. And that's all I care about. And so I was doing this. And I had bottles hidden all over strategic locations, and it was, whatever. I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous many years, and I've heard so many wonderful stories of the guys that just drink with great bravado, and they drink in your face, and they don't care how much you drink. I'm this little chicken shit drinker, afraid someone's going to see me drinking, you know, and I'm hiding the booze and the whole thing, and I'm not proud of it. I just want you to know that. I'm not proud of it. Anyway, I went on this way for a number of years. I don't know how many years. It was just a long time. And I don't know how it affected you, the alcohol, but I started to get these mood swings. I would get just terribly, terribly depressed, where I would sit in my car at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or maybe 3 o'clock in the morning beating my fists on the steering wheel, wondering what's wrong to me. Where did my life all go to hell? What is so awful about this? It was just awful. I would sit there and cry and carry on and talk about and getting in all this kind of drama. And yet, maybe the next night or just a few hours earlier or later, I'd have 27 scotch and waters at some club and drive half of you home. I mean, you couldn't predict how the hell I was going to be. And it was just, you know, dance wildly all night long. It was just, you couldn't predict how I was going to be. And it worried me so much. And I was coming in and out of blackouts. I don't mean the kind of blackouts that most of us relate to, where you wake up in the morning wondering what you did last night, because half the stuff that you forget isn't even worth remembering. But I'm talking about driving down Wilshire Boulevard at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and all of a sudden you come to and you wonder, where am I going? What job am I going on? What did I do this morning? Have I had lunch? You know, and it was just very upsetting. And so I sought the help of a psychiatrist, something we all used to do in the late 50s and early 60s. And I found a doctor I had a pretty good rapport with. And I told him about my highs and my lows and about the strange relationship with my growing up and the problems with the wife and the kids and all that sort of stuff, except one small thing. He kept asking me, how much do you drink, Tom? And I told him, 6 or 8 ounces of alcohol a day, doctor. It seemed like a normal amount for a heavy drinker to drink. I'm more than happy to be a heavy drinker, because it is, after all, a sign of manhood or adulthood. For me to control and enjoy my drinking is my great obsession. I didn't quite understand when I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. And when I was enjoying it, I certainly wasn't controlling it. But I couldn't see any of that in those days. And all I really wanted was to have people get off my goddamn back and leave me alone. And, I mean, I go to work every day consistently. I take the kids to Indian guides and the beach and the movies they want to see and bowling and all the other BS that they want to do, you know. And, I mean, just Indian guides and whatever else it was. As long as I had fresh alcohol in my system that I could maintain and sustain what I was supposed to do. And I went on this way and did all this sort of stuff. And so I think if I drink a little bit too much, what's the big deal, you know? And I look back on it now after all these years, and I still think, what's the big deal? You know, it just makes such a big case out of my drinking. I mean, why is this such a big focal point of everybody's life, it seems like? Anyway, I hate to sound paranoid, but... Anyway, I saw this doctor about 3 or 4 years in a private therapy and group therapies and all the therapies you can dream up. And what happened to me, because I couldn't be honest about my number one problem, which is my alcoholism, my drinking, is that I got sicker and sicker and sicker in this guy's care. And it wasn't his fault. He just didn't have he didn't have very good tools, I guess, to work with or a subject. And it was just terrible, and it was just awful. But, you know, when you're in therapy or when you're in some sort of modality of recovery or whatever they're calling it this week, it's just a different – people treat you differently. They think, well, he's trying to get help, and he's trying to do this and whatever, and they get off your case. And it was very much that way with me. And I, you know, was doing okay. And I don't know how this how it all sort of worked out, but I was sitting in the little club in the, right around the corner of my psychiatrist's office in Beverly Hills, and I hadn't had a drink since noon. I'm getting a little shaky, and I go up the bar, and I have 3 or 4 double scotches or whatever it was that I'm drinking. And you always look better when you leave a bar. I mean, all of us do. You can look at the back bar and see that. But you feel better, and you can relate better to the psychiatrist and talk more honestly. And I'm sitting in this doctor's office. And about 10 minutes into the session, he looked at me, and he said, you know, you're drunk. I said, what do you mean I'm drunk? He said, you look drunk, you act drunk, and you smell drunk. I assume you're drunk. I said, well, a couple of beers for lunch, which I think is our stock answer. And he says, I think it's a little bit more than that, a little bit more recent, and it's going to help me with my drinking problem. Albeit my non-existent drinking problem, but I'll go along with the gag, whatever. And he put me in heavy dose of Librium and heavy dose of Stelazine. And if I took the, you know, he told me to take the pills as prescribed, and of course, you know, I took them more than prescribed because, what are they? In fact, he even told me not to drink with these things, but what do they know? And so I'm trying to work, you know, and doing my electrical work. I'm doing remodels and kitchen remodels and all kinds of stuff in that area that I'm that I was working in. And I mean, I am not aware of any major problems or any major fires or anything like that. Hey, but shit happens. And so anyway, I'm trying to keep body and soul together with this whole thing. I found out sort of resentfully just a few years ago when the film A Beautiful Mind came out, and I found out those are the same drugs they gave him, which I must have been in the hands of an incompetent or something. I just don't really know how that happened. Anyway, I drive down Wilshire Boulevard, get to a little silly corner like Wilshire and Westwood about 10 o'clock in the morning, wait for the signal to change, take about an hour and a half, and I'd come to, and the lady in front of me said I ran into her car, which I suppose I did. I don't know. I'm not the best witness. And come home some nights, rip that house apart, terrorize that wife and family. Some nights, come home just as peaceful as I am this evening, even more peaceful. Come home 6, 7 o'clock at night, lay down the living room rug, take a little nap before dinner time. Sometimes I'd miss dinner, but there's other meals. And I'd get up 11, 12 o'clock at night, go take a leak in the linen closet and go to bed. Just, you know. My wife is losing her sense of humor over this kind of stuff, which they'll do, so she files for divorce. And I'm out in the street, the miserable bitch. And here I am, you know. So, hey, I'm the victim here. I'm the victim here. I'm looking for a place to live. And I got myself a one-room place right behind my favorite drinking bar called the Cork and Fork on Westwood Boulevard. And I had sort of... Hey, you know, you're going to give a bad impression of the new people here tonight. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're not supposed to be having such a good time. Anyway, it was horrible. This is about 1965, I guess. And I was living alone in this one-room place. And I was even hiding the booze for myself in this place. Go figure. Old habits die hard, I guess. something I thought of, it must be about 10 years ago, I was thinking about it, it reminded me that when I would, you know, in those days, it was the days before cell phones and the days before answering services and all that sort of stuff, and we'd make our phone calls at night, you know, after work, and I would sit there in kind of like in the dark, planning my next couple of days, and I would be talking on the phone, and I'd have my glass of booze here, and when I would take a drink, I'd put the phone over here so they could not hear that I was drinking. I mean, you know, I don't understand that, never did, never will. I don't really think so. Anyway, my wife came to visit me in October of 65. She said she wanted to see me that I wasn't drinking. It was kind of like home in my vodka break, and I was sitting there, and she told me what kind of a husband I was, what kind of a father I was, what kind of a son I was to my own mother and dad, and what was I going to do about Christmas was coming up, and the kids needed toys and shoes or whatever it was they needed. The attorney wants to be paid, and they've turned the electricity off again. They're going to turn the phone off. When you go about this, and I don't know what she's telling me about these mundane problems of hers. I've got my own problems. Anyway, mercifully, she left in about 20 minutes, and I just sort of flipped out. I went temporarily insane. I just went crazy. Fortunately for me, the night before, I had just purchased a bottle of Secanol sleeping pills, which I took all of those, about 100 of them, and a bunch of scotch, and I lay down that little cot to go to sleep. Because, I mean, you know, you get to a point with your alcoholism and your drug addiction where you really can't do it anymore. I know we joke in here about this time it'll be different and I can handle it now or whatever it may be, but I realized it wasn't going to be any different, and please don't suggest that I not drink, because drinking is the only thing that allows me to work. I can't work on hot wires and stuff like that. I'll blow everything up if I'm shaking. I can't talk without stuttering, so I have to have fresh alcohol so I can talk. Talk about don't drink and drive. How the hell do you drive if you don't drink? I don't understand all that. And I just wanted out. I just didn't want to have to deal one more day with what was going on. I know there's a lot of people in this room that felt the same way. And a kid that was working for me part-time thought I was acting a little bizarrely, and he came to my apartment just to check on me. I guess he could see I was getting very strange. And they found me in this coma. And I guess they get the door open some way. And they call the ambulance, and they ship me up to UCLA Medical Center, where they pump me full of holes, and I was to stay in there for about 13 hours in this coma. And I guess they pumped my stomach. I don't know why I wasn't there. And I came to in this funny-looking green room, and I thought, Christ, I've even screwed this up. I can't even get out of here. Talk about bad breaks. And when my vital signs came around, they put me in another ambulance and they shipped me off to a mental institution where I should stay for a while, but not for alcoholism, something respectable, suicide. And I was in this hospital. It wasn't all that bad. They were very kind to me there. It was clean. It was very pleasant, as mental institutions can be. I had a 24-hour-a-day guard on me. I guess they were afraid I was going to do something rash. And I was in there. I made my little ashtray well enough. They let me out eventually. And the first place I stopped was Jerry's Liquor Store in Olympic, and I bought a quart of vodka and a quart of scotch. And of all the things that I talk about in this phase of my talk, that's the most bizarre to me. Because wouldn't you think I'd stay sober a couple of months, a couple of weeks, a couple of days, a couple of hours? But I know I can't go back in my room naked with nothing to drink because I drank it all up, so I had to stop and get a quart of each. And I stayed drunk that weekend, but I'm drunk every day. It didn't make any difference. And I went to work on Monday morning, and I got on the fourth rung of a ladder to change some light bulbs, which is not overly technical. And I couldn't do it. I was too shaky and too upset. I didn't have enough drink that morning. And the people on Sunset Boulevard going to work were pointing up at that crazy electrician on that ladder. And I said, Mrs. Pauly, I'll come back another day. I gave her the same lame excuse, like I had the flu or something like that. And what happened is that I checked in with another psychiatrist. This went 5 days a week. If you're wondering how I'm affording a psychiatrist 5 days a week, I'm not. My daddy's taking care of me. I'm only 32 years old. I can't take care of myself or raise my family or do anything that any other self-respecting, responsible 32-year-old man would do. And I felt like such a little boy, like such a failure. And of course, I felt like I, what I was. And I went to Mass on Christmas of 1965, and I asked God to grant me some peace. I didn't want to quit drinking, but I wanted to sleep for more than 2 hours at a time. If you drink the way I drink, and it affects you like it does me, getting to sleep, if you drink all through the day after 8 or 9 o'clock at night and you've had over 2 quarts of booze, you pass out, which is fine with me. I have no quarrel with that. But unfortunately, it affects me in such a way I wake up in 2 hours, just as wide awake as I am this evening, and I can't get back to sleep unless I pace that room back and forth and back and forth and drink some more and walk some more and wear myself out so I can pass out again and wake up in 2 or 3 hours. That's what my life had been reduced to in 1965. And I just didn't know what the hell else I was going to do. I don't know. You know, I can't commit suicide. I tried that and failed that. And I just didn't know what the hell I was going to do. So I asked God to grant me some peace. And 2 days later, my prayer was answered, although I didn't see it as such. But I woke up one morning. Nothing new had happened in my life. There was no new trauma. And I went to my linen closet where I was still hiding the booze for myself and got my morning drink out, my morning vodka, and had another one. 8 o'clock in the morning came, and I had a half a pint to a pint of my stomach where I could, you know, get myself together so I could go off and go to work. And I went and put the bottle of vodka back on the top shelf, and I noticed a bottle of Ballantine scotch had about that much left it. And I thought, Christ, that's a lot of scotch since 8 o'clock the night before. It was remarkable how much I was drinking, yet it was no more or no less that I was drinking all the way along, but it was kind of like shown to me. And I went to the phone a few hours later, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous, of all places. And I went to a meeting that night at Ohio Street in West Los Angeles. And I sat in the back of the room where you're supposed to sit when you're new. Don't get up too close, and don't pick up any coffee cups. I'll think you're a member. And I sat back there in my hands because I was afraid someone was going to see me shaking because I didn't have enough to drink before I went to the meeting. And I was sort of purple in color. I had green slime coming out of my mouth, and the breath purifier was I was chewing, so nobody knew I was drinking. I was sweating profusely on this cold January night, and some jerk who I was sitting next to raised my hand as a newcomer, which I think was very nice. And I don't know how the hell he knew I was a newcomer. I sure as hell didn't tell him. But that was the night I walked up to a man who's to be my sponsor, not knowing any of this. He was the secretary of that particular group that night. And I said, excuse me, sir, you seem to be some sort of a big deal around here. How do you join Alcoholics Anonymous? How do you become a member? And he says, you don't drink, kid. I said, yes, I'm planning on cutting down. He said, no, you don't have a grasp of it. You don't drink here a day at a time. I said, it's very easy for you to say. Apparently, you're sober sometime, but I can't go a whole day without a drink. I tried it one day in July, and it damn near killed me. Well, he thought that was so goddamn funny, and he got some of the guys he sponsored and dragged them up to me, you know, and made me repeat what I had just said to him so they could get a laugh out of it. Sounds kind of cruel and cold today, but it's kind of true. I guess if you can't exploit and make fun of the new people, what good are they? And so I went back to my psychiatrist, talking about these insane eight meetings and these crazy people and these bizarre stories. And it was just the doctor reached out in his desk and pulled a whole big bag of Librium and said, here, take these. It'll get you the rust spots. I thought, great, no problem. I made the mistake, though, of sharing this with my soon-to-be sponsor. And he informed me if I was going to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous as opposed to one that just didn't drink. But if you're going to be sober and be in a position to work this program, we don't drink here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't smoke marijuana. We don't take pills that affect the neck up. We don't shoot non-habit-forming heroin. I guess if you came in today, they'd tell you to cut back a little bit at least on your cocaine and crack. But to be sober is to be sober. It's to be sober. Hard to get that concept. You don't drink with anything? I mean, you can't even have beer with Mexican food? I mean, that's un-American. And so but you just don't drink with anything. And it's hard to get that concept. But this man was able to convince me that I could get out of my apartment one particular day and go down to Santa Monica Beach on a cold January day. And I walked up and down that beach shaking and sweating and every nerve in my body calling out to give me some booze, give me something. I didn't drink all that morning or that afternoon. I drank Carol syrup and a lot of coffee, several Hershey bars. I've always died of a diabetic coma, but somehow I didn't. I didn't drink all that morning or that afternoon, and I went to a meeting that night. When I was sitting in that meeting, I realized the longest time I'd been without a drink since I was a junior in high school. I thought, how amazing, miraculous. And it's hard to believe that this coming January has been 40 years since it's been going like... No, that cuts into my time. And I mean, it's just awesome to me. And I mean, it's really little else than just coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and getting his man as a sponsor and doing this deal and getting on this journey. And that's what I've done. I've really done little else than that. I got very active on the program. My wife and I reconciled at some naive idea that she was going to go to Al-Anon and get the kids to go to Al-Ateen and Al-Atat and get the get the dog to go to Al-Pet and all this stuff, but it was not going to happen. She couldn't see the need for Al-Anon in her life. It was, after all, my problem. And so she continued on with her psychologist, and I went to AA. And I guess there was a certain amount of a honeymoon those first 7 or 8, 9 months. But, you know, it doesn't last forever, as those of us that know. And they want to know why you're still going to all those meetings. And my mother used to tell me you deprive your family of your presence and all on and on. And I, maybe so. I don't know. I don't want to get into that controversy. But it seemed like I needed to not only immerse myself in Alcoholics Anonymous, and not so much with the program and not so much with the steps, but I needed to immerse myself with the fellowship, with the people who were doing the impossible thing, and that was to stay sober. For us, in that year that we were all together, we just didn't drink a day at a time. We had relationships and families and businesses and work and all that sort of stuff, and we used to sit in those coffee shops, as John and I were talking about before the meeting. John and I were, John's older than, a lot older than me, but he's got more sobriety than I do. Not a lot, but some. He calls me a newcomer. Anyway, it was amazing, and we all stuck together and stayed away from the first drink, and to the best of my knowledge, those of us are still alive are still sober. It's really remarkable. I flipped out when I was sober about 8 or 9 months. I don't know, I went to a very meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, speaker meeting on a Friday night, and I left that meeting just as crazy and as goofy as I've ever been or been since. And I left the meeting crying and laughing maniacally, and I went down to the Santa Monica Beach this full moon night. That was wrong with me. I walked around, tried to sort it all out, and I couldn't, and I ended up at my sponsor's house quite late that night, got him out of bed, as a matter of fact. And he came to the front door and wanted to know why I was parked on his front lawn. I said, I haven't got time to park the car. I've got to talk to you now. Anyway, he made me park the car on the street with the rest of the cars, and which I did. And we came in and talked around his coffee table. And the reason we have sponsors is because we sponsors, and I sponsor really too many people, but we sponsors, our job is that we have magic sentences. That's our job. And you come to us with the problem or a myriad of problems, and we lay one of these magic sentences on you. Or if it's a very serious problem, maybe two magic sentences. And this particular night, he was out of them. And he told me to go home, and it was time for me to do a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And I didn't say how it applied to me. I spent so much of my life in the Catholic system of examination of conscience and confession. If that's not a fourth and fifth step, what is? Years I spent in the psychiatrist offices talking about what I used to be like, what happened, what I'm like now. And he cursed me and embarrassed me, and against my better judgment, I had to go home and start this four-step. And I was able to put in that four-step things I was never able to tell a Catholic priest in confession because they were too tacky, too embarrassing, too sinful of you, things that I couldn't tell a psychiatrist. You can't tell them that kind of stuff. They'll think you're crazy. So you got to be very guarded what you tell people in that venue. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start and put all that crap down and put your goals down. Find your stuff you're never going to go to the grave with type thing, as it says in our book. And put that stuff down. Get it all out. And then share it with your sponsor or whoever you're going to share it with. And I did all that. And I think he was going to like me when it was over with. And he seemed rather bored through it all. And after I've heard, I don't know how many, so many, and they're all about the same. There's just so much you can do, and there's just so much you can think about, and there really are no big deals. And we're just men and women who try to fit in and try to do what we think is correct or whatever, and screw up constantly and keep doing things over and over again. And it wasn't until after I did this fifth step, and then he made me go to a service station. I got on my knees and took a sixth and a seventh step, and then I started to get a handle on what this thing was all about. And I made a list of people I had harmed. I thought I'd done a pretty good eighth step until I was having having lunch one day with an old friend of mine who's long passed on now, Eddie Regan. And he had a printing outfit up in Hollywood. And he wanted me to go home and open up that drawer and get out all those bills. And I wonder how the hell he knew about that drawer. I just still don't know how he knew about that. And I did that, and I was able to take a stack of bills, overdue bills. I didn't read them, of course. I just stuck them in the drawer. And I got them down to a manageable amount of bills. It was over $16,000, which today's money it would be manageable. In those days, it was just it was overwhelming. There was no way I could do it. But I contacted all these people and made arrangements to pay them back. And it took me 11 and a half years to get out of debt. And I've been in and out ever since. And it's kind of like the American way. But I did it. It would have taken me a lot less if I had been a little bit more thorough and fearless from the very start. But you do what you can do. But that's what I did. I got on this journey of uncovering, discovering, and discarding, trusting God, cleaning house, and helping others. And that's what our program basically is. And that's what I've been doing ever since. And I not try to complicate it all. I just sort of simple doing these things. I sponsor a lot of guys that they were always after me. They want to do something special or something, get into this whole whatever. And I just, you know, just stay sober, you know, and work the steps and do this stuff. And it's really a very simple program. Anyway, I did all this whole stuff. I started to pray for things, which I was told not to, but what do they know? One time I prayed for a brand new Chevy van, which I needed in my business. And I got it within 3 days, just the one I wanted. And sometime after that, my higher power didn't see it clear enough to give me enough work that season to came and repossess the goddamn thing. But it taught me to go back to praying only for the knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry it out. And for years, I gave him suggestions, and he's never paid any attention to me. So trust me, it doesn't make any doesn't do any good. And you just, you know, suit up and show up and just keep doing the next indicated thing and see if you can help people and do it. I looked around when I was sober almost 8 years at these two little towhead, darling little handsome boys, and they were getting out of high school, both of them stoned out of their minds, selling drugs out the back door. He couldn't walk in the living room without getting contact high. And it was just playing that music and all that. It made me crazy to be in that household. My wife at the time was going along with what the kids were doing, and it was just, my youngest son said our family gave a whole new meaning to the word dysfunctional. And anyway, that's when my wife filed for divorce, and that was in January of 74. And that's when I moved down to Dana Point, where I live near now. And I was driving down the freeway. I was thinking, am I doing my will or his will? You know, when you're around here, well, you don't want to screw this thing up. You want to do it correctly. And so I said a prayer that my sponsor gave me. I'll share it with you. It goes like this. God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me, and I cannot know for certain where it'll end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe this. I believe the desire to please you does, in fact, please you. And I hope I have that desire in everything I do, and I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. And I know if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it at the time, nor may seem to be lost in the very shadow of death. I'll not be afraid because I know you will never leave me to face my troubles all alone. And with this, I continued on the freeway. And of course, I immediately told him what kind of apartment I wanted, what the business would be run. Of course, none of which happened. I was about 20 seconds too late for the Yellow Pages, so I had to spend a whole year without any advertising, try to run a business in a new community with no advertising. That was fun. Back and forth to Los Angeles, and that first year was just was not very good. It was a horrible year, and missing the kids and being single again, it was just a lot of fun year. I started a date again, which was a little awkward, but I wasn't too good at it in high school, much less when I'm in my early 40s. And I dated a girl for a while, and then it got too crazy, so I broke it off, and then we got back together again in August around our birthdays. Her birthday was the 20th, and mine's the 19th of August. And we went out to dinner, and she was going to pick the dinner up, and so I figured, you know, what can I lose? I'm very romantic. And so we start up again. And when she was having a radical mastectomy in South Coast Hospital in 1977, January, I went to visit her. I said, where are you going to move to? And she said, well, I don't feel like going here. I'll come home with me, and I'll take care of you until you start to feel better, which she did. And the relationship intensified, and we were ultimately married. We had a good marriage. I think we got along very well and did fine. The only problem in the marriage was, other than her cancer, with my two drug addict alcoholic children, her three daughters and a son, who are not much better condition than my kids are in. And of course, they love to come to visit us in their various stages of stoneness. It was just a joy to watch. And we got through all. They're all sober today, those that are still alive. And it was fun. When my youngest son fell out of a second-story window, stoned on angel dust and some cheap wine, I went to visit him up in General Hospital in East L.A., and I said, Jim, this is much to shoot for. Why don't you get out of this scuzzy city and come on down to Dana Point, and I'll put you to work, and you can get yourself an apartment and come to work for me. And he said, oh, no, Dad, I'm having too good a time. So he did come down eventually and stayed sober in front of me because he knew I wouldn't have anybody in my business who was loaded. And he got picked up one Saturday night for drunk walking. And when he got out of jail, he realized he had to quit drinking. And did it all on Quaaludes and marijuana, which is another way to get sober, I guess. And I didn't know that he was doing this. He's not going to tell me. And our first speaker talked about Norm Alpe. Well, he was the speaker this particular Wednesday night. And I said to Jim, I said, why don't you come to the meeting tonight? And this speaker is our best speaker in AA, and you may enjoy him. And he came strictly for the entertainment value and stayed. And that was hard to believe. He just celebrated last May 26 years in the program. And my oldest boy, who just talked here a couple of weeks ago, I guess 3 weeks ago, Chris, he'll have 23 years in December. So I'm very blessed to have these the sober kids in my house. And Alcoholics Anonymous obviously has made such a great impact on our lives. Anyway, my wife passed away the day after Christmas of 1985, and it was just a devastating thing to go through. I mean, I just couldn't adjust to it. I naively, maybe, I'd done a third step on her cancer, and she died anyway. And there's something wrong with this picture. And it was 1986 was a terrible year. I had no joy. I just somehow put one foot in front of the other. I did all the AA shit that you do, and I went to work and did all that stuff, but I had no joy at all. It was just trudging through this awful year. And after it was over with, and I got through it, which we all get through stuff, I realized I had done a third step, and the third step did work, because it says, my God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And that's what my job is now. That's my job, is to see if I can help people. And I'm in a position because of my experience. And so all we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous is our experience. And my experience is such that I know you can get through anything if you just don't pick up that first drink. And things will pass. I got into a terrible depression in 93. I guess it was a clinical depression, and they suggested very strongly that I get on this antidepressant stuff. And I said, well, thank you for sharing. But I've been sober, I don't know what it was in those days, but, it's just not my style. And I went through it all and ended up having to do a 10-step on this particular thing that was going through, this particular loss that I had. And I got through it, and which we do, came out the other end. I'm very grateful that I didn't go that other route, which was highly suggested to me, but just wasn't my style. I took 1986 off, obviously, and I guess about a year later, I was watching this beautiful blonde lady get her fifth cake. I thought, now there is a classy-looking lady. And I was happy to be sitting next to her sponsor that particular night. And I said, think she'd like to go out with me? He said, I think you two would be fun together, whatever. So I got her sponsor's permission, and I asked Gloria to go out on a date for that weekend. And we've been together ever since. We have a lovely marriage, a happy, loving marriage, and we have a lovely home in Laguna Niguel. And we just, AA is the top thing in our life, and we just love it. And it's quite a remarkable thing. And I don't know, I've just had a good life. I have a lot of fears and a lot of, stuff. I'm getting old. I told a guy at the gym last August on my birthday, I said, well, wish me a happy birthday. Today's my birthday. And he said, well, how old are you today, Tom? And I said, 42. And the guy looked at me. He says, well, you don't look it. But anyway, I worry, how much longer can I work? I work, every day, and I crawl around in attics and up and down ladders and up and down and up and down and up and down, and I'm riddled with arthritis and all that whole stuff. And I live in the wreckage of my future. And what I try to do actively is just stay in the now. As long as I continue to do what I'm doing, right now I'm doing fine. And how long that's going to last, I don't know. Anyway, I've enjoyed this evening very much, and I wish you all well, and you can find what I found, that you can live happily and soberly the rest of your life if you want to. Thank you very much.